This sounds like a joke, but it's true. I had a friend who got a PhD in philosophy, lost track of him for a couple of years. We made contact again. I said, what have you been doing? He said, oh, I spent the last 2 years at the University of Toronto. I got a second PhD. I said, what in? He said, psychology. I said, oh, that's a nice combination. Why did you get a second PhD in psychology? He said, well, as a philosopher, I read all the great philosophical classics, and I started reading Freud. And Freud convinced me that sex was important, so I thought I should learn more about it. I don't think sex was talking about, Freud was talking about PhDs. Freud is right about a lot of things. Freud's a wonderful thinker. He's a little nutsy. Geniuses often are. And on opposite pages, almost, of my favorite book of Freud's, namely Civilization and Its Discontents, which is his most philosophical and one of his latest, there's a long footnote about the origin of civilization having a lot to do with the fact, and he says this without any trace of humor, that primitive man discovered at one point or other that he could control fire by peeing on it, but woman couldn't, and therefore therefore civilization was born from urethral eroticism, he said. And then almost a page or two later, he asked the wonderful question, now that we don't need religion anymore because we've become gods ourselves, now that all these wish-fulfilling desires of the conquest of nature and almost divine wisdom and power have been given to us so that we don't need these heroes or Superman figures anymore, we ought to be happier since everybody wants happiness above all. And everything that we do, including civilization itself, is done as a means to attain happiness. Well, either we're unhappier than our ancestors, or at least no happier than our ancestors. Why is that? Why didn't it work? And he confesses he doesn't really know the answer, and then the last half of the book is just meandering about some fancy theories about repression and how it might work. What a great question. Bad answer. Great question. Sometimes it's worth buying a book just for one question. Well, Freud is right. Sex is important. Much more important than most people would admit before Freud. So thank you, Freud, for enlightening us about that. We don't have to go to the University of Toronto and spend 3 years getting a PhD to learn it. It's also ubiquitous. That is, it's not an isolatable dimension of our lives. If you woke up tomorrow morning and discovered that you were a woman rather than a man, that would change everything. Everything, literally. When a man prays, he prays as a man. And a woman prays, she prays as a woman. I'm convinced that if Freud were alive today, he would side with the Catholic Church about no priestesses. Because, not that he was an anti-feminist, but because he realized that that is an issue that's not just imagery. To pray to a god that you can call she is a different religion. It changes everything. Well, Freud understood something that most people no longer understand, especially after the so-called sexual revolution, namely that sexuality is something that you are, not just something that you do. The word sex used to mean what we now mean by the word gender. You have sex. During World War II, there was a joke, draftees induction form, sex, supposed to be male or female. Maybe. Answer, yes. Often.
Yeah.
Gender, on the other hand, was a word that was used to refer to a grammatical entity, namely the part of speech of a noun. Nouns in most languages had gender, masculine or feminine or neuter. By the way, English is almost the only, as far as I know, language in the world which does not have masculine or feminine nouns. Which means that we're the last people that understand what sex is. to identify or to confuse what you are with what you do is either to reduce your being to doing or to exalt your doing to being. To reduce your being to doing, that's Marthaism. You know the Mary and Martha story. Martha was, you know, she would have invented committees. And Jesus said to her, poor Martha, don't you know that there's only one thing necessary? Mary knows it. What was she doing? She was just being. The essential thing that a human being has to be, namely a creature. A listener. A couple hundred years ago, Francis Bacon, who sort of trumpeted the modern scientific revolution, said, and most classical modern philosophers follow here, that the biggest difference between medieval philosophy and modern philosophy, or medieval attitudes and modern attitudes, is that the medievals were contemplative and the moderns are activists. Man is no longer homo sapiens, but homo faber. No longer the animal that is wise, but the one that is a maker, a doer. The conquest of nature, the active conquest of nature, is our nunc sum bonum. Every society in the history of the world had some version or other of Islam, surrender, submission to some higher power, some ultimate meaning, as their summum bonum. There were very different versions of it, but to conform the human soul and human life to the ultimate nature of objective reality, whatever that was the supreme purpose of human life. That was at least a consensus, although there was a lot of difference about what reality was and how you did that conforming. But we are living in a radically new experiment in civilization. The first civilization who says, we don't know what the meaning of life is. We know how to put a man on the moon and how to destroy the world, but we don't know what the meaning of life is. We are the first civilization who finds its fundamental meaning not in conforming the soul to objective reality, but in conforming objective reality to the wishes of the soul. And the way you do that is a technique, a technology. Which is why we're much, much better at technology than any other society in history. Not because we're smarter, but because we love it. That's terribly important. That's getting to heaven, so to speak. This is going to apply to the sexual revolution. I just need a couple of middle terms. We tend then to be functionalists, Baconians, Promethean, who grab the fire from heaven for ourselves, control freaks, pragmatists. So we reduce our being to doing. So sex is something you do, not just something you be. Although, as little children, we're not yet conditioned by that society, so we still have the notion of sexual being. I think it was Erikson, Freud's maverick disciple, although I'm not sure. It might have been Abraham Maslow, who did elaborate experiments on how one-year-olds played. And he was careful to get one-year-olds who hadn't been conditioned by so-called sexual stereotypes. You play with trucks, you play with dolls, you do pink, you do blue. And he observed that in over 80% of all the cases, the boys played in different ways than girls did. They played more violently, they played more destructively, and they liked phallic symbols. They like to bash onto things, whereas girls tried to bring things together in womb-like ways. So there was something innate, something in their being, that conditioned their doing. Reducing being to doing is one half of the picture, but when that leaves a great vacuum in your being, you've got to fill it somehow. So you pick some particular doing and exalt that into your being. Classic case, the homosexual community. I never heard of a committed homosexual activist who didn't firmly and aggressively believe that homosexuality is not just something we do, but something we are. Any attack on homosexual activity at all is an attack on their being.
I had a most interesting dialogue once with a disciple of Andrew Sullivan, who gave a talk at Boston College entitled, A Catholic Homosexual Criticizes His Oppressive Church. And the point of the talk, I didn't hear it, but I read it, was I'm a Catholic, and I want to be a Catholic, and the church says that they love me, but they don't love what I do. I reject that distinction. That's impossible. They don't understand us. This is what we are. This is not just what we do. If you criticize what we are, you criticize what we... excuse me. If you criticize what we do, you criticize what we are. Love the sin, hate the sinner. Hate the sin, love the sinner. Freudian slip there. That's hypocrisy. So, having read that, I got a chance to ask him afterwards. He didn't know who I was or anything. I just identified myself as a Catholic who believed everything that the church taught, including the two most important things it teaches about homosexuals, namely, one, that they're called to be saints and they're loved by God and they must be loved by us, and number two, that what they do is wrong and contrary to their own nature and God's will. And he said, yeah, I know, that's a standard position. I hate that. I said, why? Why? I didn't say, why do you call yourself a Catholic? But I said, why are you the only people in the world that refuses to distinguish what you are from what you do? I'm a coward, and if I were an alcoholic, I could say I am an alcoholic if I went to AA, but I wouldn't say that's my whole being. And you say that's your whole being. Why are you the only people to do that? He said, well, I can't speak for anybody else, but I'll speak for myself. I'll try to answer that question if you'll really listen. I said, I really do want to know, because I don't understand. He said, well, let's suppose the shoe were on the other foot. Suppose you Catholics, you Orthodox Catholics, were the small minority who was misunderstood and persecuted throughout history, and the establishment said to you, we hate what you do. We hate the Mass. We hate prayer. We hate the sacraments. We hate the Bible. We hate priests. We hate cathedrals. But we love you. And we hope that we can persuade you to abandon this horrible thing that you do. But we really love you. Wouldn't you feel personally threatened? And wouldn't you think that distinction between what you are and what you do is a little fake? And instead of giving a flip answer, since I really wanted to understand him, I thought for a minute, honestly, and I said, you know, you're right. I never realized that before. I would, that's exactly how I would feel. You threaten my identity. Because Catholicism is not just a set of clothes that I chose to wear. That's who I am, not just what I do. But look at your title. Your title of your speech, A Homosexual Catholic or A Catholic Homosexual Criticizes His Oppressive Church. Which of those two words, Catholic or homosexual, is your religion? Since your religion is your identity. And he smiled and he said, I think we've both learned something from each other today. So at least he admitted that this was a religion. And I think that's true. I think for the at least intelligent and aggressive homosexual activist, this is not just a cause, like, oh, communism or anti-segregation or environmental responsibility. This is an identity. This is a religion. That's what they feel. And I think that's a kind of compensation for our functionalist society in which our being is reduced to our doing. So there's a hole in our being, so something in our doing that's most exciting to us, which for the homosexual is homosexual sex, now gets into the throne position and becomes their being. So paradoxically, the cause of that idolatry of doing into being is the reduction of being to doing. Which I find also in abortion. Here's a parallel issue. There's a puzzle here. I really do not understand how the second strongest instinct in nature, after self-preservation, namely motherhood, could in one short generation so be totally conquered. It's amazing. Our ancestors did not understand it. Just suppose somebody from the 50s had been Rip Van Winkle into the present after Roe v. Wade. He would say that's impossible. Impossible. And yet, it happened. And it wasn't just a political ploy. Somehow, Western civilization has become convinced that this is a permissible thing. Well, the answer is very obvious. In no other case do we think that deliberately murdering innocent human beings is a good thing. Nowhere else. Only in the womb. Least safe place in the world. Why? Well, because abortion is about sex. How is it about sex? No, just think. Why does any woman want an abortion? Abortion is backup birth control. All right, her birth control failed, so this is her last-ditch attempt not to have a baby. Ah, but it's not just an attempt not to have a baby. It's an attempt to have sex without having a baby. If babies didn't come from sex, if they came from cloning or test tubes or if storks brought them, Planned Parenthood would go broke.
Indeed.
So sex is the elephant in the abortion living room. Is there anything else like that in our society that shows that sex has become exalted into a kind of religion? Sure. Divorce. The Catholic Church is the only institution in the world that does not recognize divorce. My Protestant friends, whom I have very many, often criticize the church for being oppressive and anti-woman and so on, and they say, well, you know, you don't allow divorce for any reason. And I say, well, that's because we're not as authoritarian as you are. You're really the church that claims much more authority than we do. We can't allow divorce for the same reason we can't allow woman priests. Didn't you read what the Pope says? The church does not have the authority to ordain women. You think you do. And you think you have the authority to deliberately contradict the clear teaching of Jesus Christ in all four Gospels where he explicitly forbids divorce. So you're editing God's mail. We're just faithfully delivering it. They have no answer to that. Now, divorce has three documentable results, scientifically documentable results. Number one, child abuse. If you want to abuse your child, there are three ways to do it very successfully. One, direct sexual abuse. Number two, direct physical abuse. Number three, divorce.
Yes, that's right.
Massive statistics about how very difficult it is for a child of divorce to become happy, successful, rich, not to have a happy marriage himself, not to get into drugs, not to get thrown into jail, not to commit suicide. Every possible social indicator of happiness speaks out massively against divorce. So it's child abuse. Number two, lying, cheating, and betraying the person you say is the most important person in your life. Deliberately welching on the most solemn promise you ever make in your entire life. That's what marriage is. Well, if we can't trust you to keep that promise, how can we trust you to keep any promise whatsoever, ever? Number three. This is not as scientifically documentable. Infallibly destroying your society. In the history of the world, the health of families is the most infallible indicator of the health of societies. And by health, I mean simply longevity and peace. What are the four longest-lasting societies in the history of the world? The longest-lasting one is Jewish, Mosaic. That's not always a civil society. In fact, it's not usually a civil society. The Jews lived mostly during the diaspora. But still, a society that believed in Mosaic law and practiced it. 4,000 years long. Maintaining its identity and its stability and its unity and its teachings, it's a miracle. Nothing like it in history. Number two, Confucian China. 2,000 years it lasted. Largest nation in the world. Confucius lived in what was called the period of warring states, bloody civil wars all through China. He was not successful in his lifetime. It took a couple of generations for his teachings to become established political teaching. But once it did, until Mao Zedong, China lasted about 2,100 years based on Confucian morality. Now, Confucian morality, like Jewish morality, is very high on the family. and on family stability. Third example, Islamic society. That's a more mixed bag, but very much like Mosaic society, Islamic society is religious and moral and based on a very high regard for the family. And although divorce is allowed, it is frowned on and is very rare, at least comparatively rare compared with societies around it. And they've lasted for 1,400 years in various establishments, various forms. Fourth example, ancient Rome lasted 700 years. People dream of a one-world society in Western civilization. The European Union is trying to imitate that. Well, it happened once. It was called Rome. And Rome, although it was in many ways corrupt and polytheistic and pagan, still had a high regard for the family. The word pietas, piety, means simultaneously respect for the gods and respect for the family. The Punic Wars were fought mainly over the family. When the Romans discovered that the Carthaginians were slaughtering their own children, they realized that these were barbarians. Well, if the four longest and stablest societies in the world were based on the stability of the family, and divorce tears apart a family, we have not learned from history. Or we are challenging history. Well, one of three things is bound to happen. Either our society will be destroyed by this, or we will violate one of the most basic laws of history and we will thrive and be happy even though our families don't, or will we repent and survive through reestablishing the family? But those are the only three possibilities. Divorce is really a form of suicide. It's the suicide of a family. In some societies, the fundamental citizens are not individuals, they're families. And even if the primary object of a census is individuals rather than families, still, the primary cause of the health of a society is healthy families. So, if you found a society in which 50% of its citizens committed suicide, would you say that's a healthy society?
No.
Would you say that's stable? Would you say that has a happy future ahead of it? Obviously not. Welcome to America. 50% of our families commit suicide. That's desperate. Now, if divorce were not connected with sex, and it had these same three documentable results, it would be absolutely outrageous. It would be intolerable. It would not be tolerated. But it's not only tolerated, it's expected, it's sanctified, it's glorified. Why? It has something to do with sex. I conclude that the sexual revolution is one of the most radical revolutions in the history of the world. Certainly the most radical revolution since the Incarnation. Compared to the sexual revolution, the Bolshevik revolution, the Nazi revolution, the American revolution, they were tempest in a teapot. Because sex is the origin of life itself. And if you have a different conception of the meaning of that, you have a different conception of the meaning of everything. The sexual revolution really began in the 1930s at the Lambeth Conference. We have to thank our friends, the Anglicans, who were the first Christian group in the history of the world for over 1,900 years to come up with the radical thought that contraception is okay. That was universal consensus until the Lambeth Conference. Even Freud, atheist as he was, thought, well, of course contraception is unnatural. It was universal consensus. Until John Paul II's Theology of the Body, even most Orthodox Catholics who agreed with Humanae Vitae didn't really understand it. They said, well, it's just a matter of obeying the natural law. We don't understand why that's part of the natural law. Instinctively, contraception seems okay, but the church says it's not, so we'll obey the church, fine. But we don't have the big picture in our mind. It's a matter of faith and obedience. Well, George Weidel is certainly right when he says that the theology of the body is a theological time bomb, and maybe the most important theological development in 700 years since the Summa Theologica, because it gives you that big picture. To separate sex from babies, to separate the unitive from the procreative dimension of sex, which is the very essence of the strategy of contraception. Not an accident, the essence. To do that is like divorce itself. Or like suicide, separation of the soul and the body. As a result, sex no longer has a teleology, a purpose, a natural end. It is simply something that happens to exist by biological accident and which is a lot of fun. And if you can somehow or other take away the side effects by which people are obviously and immediately harmed, why not? There is absolutely no reason in the nature of things why anybody who believes that contraception is okay can possibly have any objection to homosexuality. Because exactly the same principles justify or condemn both. If somebody asked me, if you could make everybody in Western civilization read one book by force, for the future of Western civilization, what book would it be? I would give you a surprising answer. My first instinct would be to say The Abolition of Man by C.S. Lewis, but then I'd think more deeply and say most people wouldn't understand or agree with that, so I'll pick something else. I'll pick Brave New World by Aldous Huxley. That's where we're going. There's our prophet. At the heart of Brave New World is, of course, the natural consequences of the sexual revolution, sex without consequences, in which the notion of babies or motherhood is now not only reduced to an accident, but to an obscenity, to something unthinkable. It's a fascinating read, and it's scary. The word sexism, funny word, it was actually invented in the 60s by, of all people, Sheldon Van Auken, who was a personal friend of mine. He was a Catholic, a convert, who lost the faith for a while in the 60s, got involved in the super liberal movement, and invented the word in an article, and somebody picked it up, and it became famous, and he apologized for it. This is in his book, Under the Mercy, which is a sequel to A Severe Mercy, which is one of the most shattering books I have ever read. It's one of the most beautiful. If you want to read a love story, a conversion story, and a death story in one honest autobiography, that is guaranteed to make you weep. Read A Severe Mercy.
The title again?
A Severe Mercy.
Okay, thank you.
By Sheldon Van Auken. What is meant by the term sexism, of course, is the old-fashioned philosophy of sex that says sex is, as Freud thought, important and definitive of your identity and profoundly meaningful. And, of course, we all know nowadays that that's not so. That's a burden around your neck, and we've shed it. I remember years ago, I think this was after watching the Red Sox do what they do best, namely what they've done in the last 2 days, I was so depressed that I felt like a masochist. Now, I'm a coward. I don't do flagellation or anything like that. But I do sometimes do very strange things. What I did was I watched soap operas all day. I wanted to go to the bottom of the barrel to share my misery with the Red Sox. So all afternoon I watched soap operas. I'd never watched soap operas before. I just thought they were unmitigated trash. So I said, well, I'm down in the dumps now. And I was amazed at how moral they were. All the characters were either good guys or bad guys. And it was very clear that the writers did have not have any sympathy with the liars and the cheaters and the oppressors and whatnot. And 8 of the 10 commandments were securely in place. Well, 8 out of 10 ain't bad. But they're not going to be in place for long. Because once the other two are gone, well, it seems to me that the moral relativism that typifies our culture so far has extended mainly to sex. Unless you're talking about lawyers now, that's different. You know, the cartoon Harvard Law School dean desk student is sitting in front of the dean's desk. He just asked for something, and the wording on the door says, Dean Harvard Law School, and the dean says, "You're asking for a course in legal ethics? I think you need a course in logic." Legal ethics, oxymoron. Bad lawyer joke. The general moral relativism in our culture is almost exclusively about sex. The sexual revolution is the fuel, the motor that drives moral relativism as its justification. Even science is skewered by that. The Darwinian fundamentalists, the so-called scientific defenses of Darwin, are not open-minded. Open-minded scientists readily admit that the theory of evolution is a theory that still needs to be to answer some questions that haven't been answered empirically yet. But the fundamentalist Darwinians will not accept any possible questioning of this theory. Why? Well, Julian Huxley, Aldous's brother, who was the main publicizer and defender of Darwin, said very simply, as soon as the Origin of Species came out, we all, that is, we intellectuals, all embraced it without even reading it, because we knew one big thing, that we didn't need God anymore, now that we had Darwin. And God interfered with our sex life. God was intolerable. If you're an ape, then it's okay to act like an ape. It's what apes do. Well, I think our treatment of this situation has to, first of all, listen and learn and realize that this is a kind of inevitable development. It's not as surprising as it seems. Once this attractive idol becomes possible to worship and serve without immediate pain, it's almost inevitable that it's going to become very popular. I quoted earlier this morning Aquinas' statement, "Man cannot live without joy. Therefore, if you don't have the spiritual joys, you have to become addicted to carnal pleasures." But in a deeper sense, I think the theology of the body shows you why. Sex is an icon. It's a holy picture. It's not a paperclip. It's something that's inherently sacred. Inherently. Not just because we say so. It's, in fact, an icon of the eternal life of the Trinity. God is love. The love of the other. The total giving of the self to the other. That's what God is. And that's what sex incarnates. That's its ultimate meaning. Well, that big picture not only explains Humani Vitae, but it shows a whole host of things. It shows, for instance, why contraception is obviously and immediately and intuitively wrong. You don't need a long argument about justice and natural law, although that's very helpful. It's wrong for the same reason that saying the Mass and when you come to the words of consecration, pretending to say them but not saying them, so that Jesus can't come, so it's only bread and wine there, because you don't want him there. What a blasphemy. Well, that's what contraception is. God wants to come. Not automatically and regularly, as in the Mass, but he wants the door open so that he can perform one of the two ongoing miracles that he performs throughout the world until the end of time. One of them is transubstantiation, and the other is conception. And when you lock the door, saying, I want all the fun, but I don't want you here, that's what contraception does. It's not only morally wrong, it's blasphemy. Because here's a sacred, miraculous, direct, divine deed that you want to make impossible. Sex isn't... the sexual revolution and contraception, its necessary sacrament, isn't just about women or about sex or about fun. It's about babies. It's about people. It's about whether a person is sacred. It's about whether every single person, no matter how little, is an intrinsically valuable and inviolable entity. And once you deny that principle, once you let that camel's nose under the tent and say, well, people are negotiable. Some people are sacred, other people aren't. Not all human beings are persons with rights, or not all persons have rights, or not all persons are sacred and inviolable. Once you let that camel's nose under the tent, the rest of the camel will come in. And by the time the crotch comes in, it's a pretty smelly camel. I don't think Auschwitz smelled very nice. We're a long ways from that, but it's the same camel. It's a one-piece camel. That's the genius of John Paul's personalism. So, if we can direct people's attention from the specifically sexual nature of the sexual revolution to this much more radical foundational principle that everything is negotiable, including persons, we're on much firmer ground. Because most people in the world today still do believe that all persons, whether they have a right to life or not, all persons are precious and inviolable. That fundamental teaching of the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, even though it's not that popular in the European Union and in certain political circles, is still massively popular. There's a massive consensus about that. So what we have to do is to get people not just to look at sex, but to look along it and ask, what does it mean? We have to somehow, I wish I could give you gimmicks and techniques for how, restore a mode of consciousness which was easy and instinctive for our ancestors, but is radical and different and a stretch for this generation. And that's what I call looking along rather than looking at, or alternatively, sign reading. In most ancient cultures, it's said that you have more than one set of eyes. You have the eyes of the body, and then you have the eyes of reason, or the eyes of the mind, and then finally you have the eyes of the heart, which is not just feeling and sentiment, sometimes called the third eye, the eye of intuitive wisdom. When I point at something, you look along that finger. You don't look at the finger. You don't say, what an ugly finger he has. Oh, gee, look, he's got a dirty finger. No, that's not dirt, that's a freckle. Look, his fingernail is too short or too long. You don't say that. You look along the finger. What is he pointing at? Oh, a door. Now, if you're an animal, you might not do that. Intelligent animals can do that. Porpoises are good at that. Dogs, sometimes yes, sometimes no. I had two dogs. They both died last year. One was a basset hound, and one was a yellow lab. And I love basset hounds because they look so sad that they make you feel happy. But he was dumb. When I point to his food, he always comes and sniff my finger. I couldn't teach him pointing. Yellow lab was different. Well, we've become basset hounds. We find it very difficult to think symbolically or analogically, or this is like that, look at that. And we fix our eyes on the finger. Well, sex is a finger. It's an interesting finger, and it's a fascinating finger, and naturally you look at it, but what does it mean? What does it point to? Well, it's about what? What is it about? It's about the other, and it's about person, and it's about love, and it's ultimately about what God is. And that's not a stretch. That's natural. Unfortunately, it is becoming increasingly difficult, in my experience, to teach people to think in a natural way in that third eye mode of consciousness. And I'm afraid that one of the reasons that it's becoming increasingly difficult is that the half of our brain that does that, the right hemisphere, actually it's not literally and geographically the right hemisphere, but they used to think that, so we still use that language. All the brain works all the time almost. But right hemisphere thinking, intuitive thinking, analogical thinking, significant thinking, is atrophying because the other half of the brain, analytical thinking, quasi-mathematical thinking, logical thinking, is getting better and better. Reason I know this is true is I got a most interesting telephone call back in the 80s from a very famous person who had just written a book that was on the New York Times bestseller list, and somebody had called him one of the six most intelligent people in the world. He was one of the... He was from some Eastern European country, and he was in the forefront of a computer revolution. He was a mathematician and some sort of amateur philosopher, and he had written a book on the computer revolution in which he warned that there would be a price to pay. And the price was basically the atrophy of the other half of the brain, because the left half works like a computer, and the right half does not. Computers can't intuitively grasp things, and computers cannot understand analogies, and computers cannot understand humor, and all those things are right brain things. Well, he bent my ear for a long time, and I was kind of flattered, because what's this famous person doing calling me? Well, in one of my early books, I had written something that revealed that I have a thing about computers. I hate, loathe, fear them, and have constant dismemberment and torture fantasies about them. When I touch them, it's like matter and antimatter. I think it's Pauli's syndrome. Everybody ever hear Pauli's syndrome? Einstein had an assistant named Pauli. Whenever he'd walk into a room full of computers, they would spontaneously malfunction. And I've done things on my computer that computer experts watch me do, and they say, that can't be done. All you did is press the right key, and the thing self-destructed. I pressed the right key, and it restores. And we do it over and over again. He said that I will make two predictions. He said he read this little personal statement that I hate computers, and he thought he had an ally, because he too hated computers, even though he was an expert in them. And he said, I sense suspicion. I was very polite. I was listening most of the time, but I thought he was an extremist, and I thought this was just my personal stupidity. But he sounded as if the devil was trying to take over the world using computers. He said, I will make two predictions. I did a little research on you, and I noticed that in 1962 you started teaching at Villanova University, and you used such and such a textbook in Aristotelian logic for the next 3 years. Get out your old tests and test students on the first act of the mind, which computers can't do, especially analogies. Whether a term is to be interpreted as univocal, equivocal, or analogical. One meaning, two different meanings, or two related meanings. They'll flunk them all. Second, I will make a further prediction. Back in the 80s, the SAT people, who designed tests that every college student has to take to get into almost any decent college, had two basic tests, the verbal aptitude test and the math test. The verbal aptitude test was divided into four sections. One of them was on analogies. He said that whole section will have to go, because in a few years, even bright Harvard students who get 100s on the rest of the test will flunk analogies, because people can't think analogically anymore, because people are being turned into computers. And that's one of the things computers can't do. So I didn't say anything. I thought that's rather radical. And I ended the phone call rather politely, and I just filed it away in the back of my consciousness. You know, geniuses can be extremists, end-of-the-world apocalyptic scenarios and all of that. I think it was only about a year when I read in the paper that the SAT people had decided to drop one quarter of their verbal aptitude test, no more analogies at all, because nobody could pass them. Even Harvard students were getting 100 in the rest of the test. So I said, good grief, one of his predictions came true. I'll try the other one. So I got out my old tests, my rather longer tests on analogies. I hadn't noticed that my current tests on analogies were integrated into a larger chapter, and students weren't doing too well on that chapter, but I didn't isolate the analogy section, so I did it this time. I give them a whole test on analogies. By gum, almost the whole class failed. It was absolutely right. And we discussed the test after class. I remember one class in particular had 50 students in it, and one of the questions was, is the word hands used equivocally, univocally, or analogically in the following sentence? With my hands, I pointed to the hands of a clock. Most of them got it wrong. A few of them got it right, of course, an analogy, but only one of them who got it right could explain why they got it right, and the rest of the class didn't understand. I said, they can't even understand that, so maybe he's onto something. Now, what has this got to sex? Got to do with sex? Well, sex is like a pointing hand. It points to something. It points to God of all things. I'll prove that from the Bible. First mention of sex in the Bible identifies it as part of the image of God. And God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him, colon, male and female created he them. Male and female is part of the image of God. That's a key theme in the theology of the body. That strikes people as very strange. It shouldn't. I have never met a single person who undertook a serious study of John Paul II's theology of the body who wasn't excited about it. I suppose there are such people. I've never met one. It's an amazing development. It's like a nature abhors a vacuum and something whooshes in to fill the vacuum. And it's obviously the right thing. What practical techniques can I offer to treat people who don't understand this, who are victimized by the sexual revolution, not only personally, but ideologically? Well, as with the other errors, I think you have to be impolite and name names. And I do think that the deeper motive here is not just pleasure, because as sex becomes a more common quality or quantity, its pleasure decreases, like any drug. You have to have higher and higher doses to create the buzz. And eventually it becomes boring. In fact, we are probably only the second civilization in history, next to late Rome, that has become bored with sex. So I don't think it's so much pleasure. I think it's power. I don't want to be told how to control this. Not even to control. I don't want to be told how to live, how to behave, how to choose. I don't want to be poked around, especially here. I don't want to surrender. I don't want to submit to a higher authority. Even though surrender and submission is necessary for erotic experience. The refusal to surrender, that's called frigidity. People who have a very formal and hierarchical and authoritarian notion of sex are often the people who enjoy it the most. And people who have the opposite, let it all hang loose notion of sex, after the first few thrills of liberation, almost inevitably drift into ennui and boredom. And since our society is now in this stage of ennui and boredom, I think they're ripe for picking. physiology of the body is going to be an exciting thing, to an alternative. So we've got to label it. We've got to give them a positive alternative. And in practice, I think we've got to call them to live differently, not just think differently. Living and thinking reinforce each other. Orthopraxy and orthodoxy go both ways. When so-called Catholic colleges encourage multi-sex dorms and the vagina monologues has a certain place in Boston, I forget the name of it, does, I think we have to, what do we have to do? We can't persuade college presidents. Jesuit college presidents are, no, my mother would not like me to finish that sentence. We always used to say, if you can't say something nice about somebody, don't say anything at all. Emphasize the positive. What's the positive? In one word, Mary. She defeated a very formidable series of foes, the devil, in various forms. Look what she did in Mexico, Our Lady of Guadalupe. I mean, here's a society much more deeply in the grips of the devil than perhaps any other society in history. The Aztecs were doing what we do, murdering a third of their children, but deliberately killing born children to sacrifice to their god. And 7 million conversions after the miracle of Guadalupe. And the church has consecrated North America to Mary. So I don't know how she's going to do it, but she can do it. She can defeat anybody. I've said too much, you have said not enough. Questions, please.
I did not understand why people today don't understand analogy. I just couldn't understand.
No, I'm an old-fashioned geezer like you. I don't understand it either.
No, but I don't understand. Why did SAT have to drop it? Why? What's the problem?
Well, they don't want to teach them that anymore. Of course they can understand it. The human brain is still the same thing. It has the same powers. But they don't teach that anymore, and they don't want to begin teaching. It's like phonics. The National Teachers Association, most corrupt union in the world, will say, anything but phonics. Teach kids to read any way you want, but phonics is a right-wing plot. We don't do phonics. But that's the only way you learn to read. Same analogy. We can do it, but we don't want to do it.
That's the way I learned, yeah. But
grammar. We don't. No more rules of grammar. No analyzing sentences. No diagramming.
Oh, that's bullshit.
One of the questions I ask my students in philosophy courses is, how many of you have learned how to diagram sentences? Every year it goes down. Now about 30%, maybe 25%. Used to be about 50, 60%. And their writing skills are atrocious.
Of course.
Well, the reason we don't do analogies anymore is because we don't do analogies anymore.
I don't understand that.
Oh, it's ideological. The analogical view of the universe is implicitly sacramental and hierarchical. It's the old world view.
I can't get my mind around that.
Science doesn't recognize analogies.
What?
Science is quantitative. The only analogies are quantitative analogies. 2 is to 4 is 4 is to 8.
Yeah, but
that kind of analogy a computer can calculate.
When we call God our Father, that's an analogy, right? Well, why isn't that understandable?
It's understandable, but it's not ideologically pure. They don't want to call God Father anymore. Tom Groom at BC, the media darling of the Boston Globe, brags that in his translations of the Bible, he never uses the word Father.
Oh,
he's very happy that God is not Father. Yeah,
no, so was not.
See, he's practicing what I preach. He's calling the devil by its name.
As pastors and confessors, pornography is very concerned for us now.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
With younger and younger children, boys especially, what do you have to do? And no one seems to have a very clear solution. You know, try this, try that.
I think you start not with the big picture of the meaning of sex. That'll take too long. But you start with the notion of freedom. It's an addiction. It's obviously an addiction, and they know it. Just as Obamacare is an offense against freedom of conscience, and people still do believe in freedom. So I think that's where you start.
I brought with me several copies of the pamphlet, Breaking Free, 12 Steps to Sexual Purity for Men. Anyone seen it?
Yes, we have.
It's very, very good. We give it out in the confessional at home. Mm-hmm. We have it out to take free on the track rack. It's very, very good, and I'd be glad if there's an opportunity to show
it. Let me give you a very simple reason why that should be on the track rack in every single church.
It should.
There was some independent, non-aligned psychological testing company that asked the question in both Catholic and Protestant churches, how many of the men in your congregation, this is, now I'm not sure whether this is the congregation of people who actually come to church or who call themselves members of that denomination, but how many of you are addicted to pornography? Not just occasionally, but regularly. Over 50%.
Certainly. Yes.
Over 50%.
Yes.
Now, suppose you knew that over 50% of your parishioners were drug addicts. Would you want to have some anti-drug program around there? Mm-hmm. It's irresponsible not to.
What do you think that's, in general, more common among men than women? What's the reason for it?
Men aren't very pretty. I don't think there's much in our bodies to attract women. It's more in our soul than our behavior.
And
it's very hard to put souls and behavior into pictures.
There is this book that's now top of the New York Times bestseller list, The 55 Shades of Grey, is female erotic pornography. It's about a woman who's in a dominated, she's being dominated by this older man, and is trying to, and realizing this is who she really is, like a new sexual identity, to be the submissive one. And it's, but it's a basically straightforward erotic
That will be increasingly true as sexual identity becomes less and less clear. We are engaged in not just moral warfare. This is spiritual warfare.
Yes.
This is obviously a plot from hell.
Yes.
This is not just from the New York Times.
Yes.
But does it also have a pornography, I understand, also has an effect on the actual function of the brain?
Oh, yeah.
On the endorphins or whatever.
Yep.
But is that a... If somebody is not ready to be scared off or thinks they're free or something, they look, you know, your brain is actually being poisoned here, just from a purely, you know, biological point of view.
Yep. This has also scared off some people from drugs. The research that hard drugs actually make the brain incapable of functioning, and not only kill off a few brain cells, but functionally impair it. People don't usually want that kind of influence on their freedom.
I've been trying to work out a kind of theory of sexual revolution. I think that, and we're talking about pornography as part of it. The sexual revolution is about ecstasy that's controlled. We even use the phrase birth control, family planning, these sorts of things to try to figure out how we can control our future. And the pornography, when people guys come to confession, they'll be like, it's been 20 years since my last confession, but I'm scared because I'm into child pornography. Or I'm into, you know, something really gross. And it's because they've lost control, and that's when they recognize they need to come back and fix things. But it's the illusion of control that is part of, it's kind of a basic human desire since the fall, to not give ourselves over to God, but to control our own future. And the everything that we're doing about the fear of lifetime marriage is for worse, for poorer. I don't want to be, I want just the upside of this. And so part of when I deal with people getting married, that's what I go right there and say, are you, ultimately are afraid of giving up control? And always the one who's most afraid of NFP is also the one who's most afraid of, I'm a control freak.
Yep.
They even see that about themselves.
Yep.
I don't know, the one who has the commitment problem. We've been living together for 12 years. I didn't want to get married because my parents were divorced, and I'm afraid of commitment.
Yep.
I guess it's more of a comment, but do you think that's there's something there?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's also connected with the fact that people are waiting longer and longer to get married. because teenagers are naturally heroic, and they will take leaps, and they will want to be knights in shining armor, and they're not such control freaks. I think once you've experienced life in the working world, you become more of a control freak.
The more educated people are that I talk to, the harder this is, the more cash out of birth control. The younger, the less educated, the more likely they want to have kids.
Right. Right. But there's a flip side to that too, because the more educated you are, the more you'll pay attention to the scientific evidence. And the scientific evidence is all on our side. And it's massive.
I think building on what they were saying, is that pornography is probably the best example of commitmentless sex.
Mm-hmm.
Commitment. And that's truly, I mean, I think the crisis we face is, you know, even in our vocations, is the fear, the dread, the absolute panic about making a lifetime commitment to something, when even marriage is not a lifetime commitment. They understand that. I mean, you're dead on, and I appreciate you saying what I thought, and probably we both thought, that you can't talk about the subject of, you know, we're talking about, in New Jersey at least, the questions go up on the state level of same-sex unions, and certainly Massachusetts and other places have dealt with it, but that we can't, you know, it's tied into contraception, and I appreciate that part. But the other part that's not being mentioned is that it's also being tied into this idea of, you know, we can't tackle it until we're ready as a church to tackle cohabitation.
Mm-hmm.
Where, again, we're, you know, on one hand, you have those who have the fecundity, who have the ability to reproduce, who don't want children, so they'll go at all levels to contracept. And then the same-sex couples who contracept, you know, where conception is an impossibility, who want the children, who will adopt and who will say and will get themselves artificially inseminated or find a surrogate and you know, and conceive with someone else but still be in their some so-called union in that way. But, I mean, I think it's... We're just, it's the ultimate in this commitmentless, you know, society.
Yep. We're not going to get very far without the big picture. The picture of sex as something holy, which unifies everything, even masturbation. Why is that wrong? Well, because the whole meaning of life is to give yourself to the other, and there's no other in masturbation. You're just giving yourself to yourself. It's autoeroticism.
Doctor, just to go back to what you mentioned earlier about Islam and family, I was having a conversation with Krishner about different religions and comparisons and so on. I spoke about at least with Islam, they're very strong in the importance of family. And he said, Father, don't kid yourself. It's not the case. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, my son is in Afghanistan. His fourth year, he's in Iraq and Afghanistan. And this really kind of, it just startled me. He said, that all the villages that he visited, no one was divorced. He said, but men had divorce. That there was a huge problem. He said it was so sickening that the men, there was a particular night in each village where he and his you know, fellow guys in the army would leave or get out of the way because of what was going to take place that night. He said almost everywhere they went in Afghanistan and Iraq, it was like a boys' night.
Mm.
And he said, so I don't know how strong they are about family. He says, and it wasn't just a few. This is what his son told him. He said, it's all the men.
Yeah.
And boys.
This is especially true, I hear, in long, well-established Muslim countries in the Near East. It's much less true of immigrants to Europe or America. And I guess that's something like the situation in Christianity, where it's weakening in many ways in Europe and Canada, but it's strengthening in poor countries in Africa, in the third world, where you struggle, where you sacrifice, where you're poor, there's a kind of moral health there.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the rich and corrupt decadence. Mm-hmm.
I'd be curious of your further thoughts on this conversation with the disciple of Andrew Sullivan. You described what happened. You basically got him to acknowledge somewhat that his homosexuality was a religion.
Mm-hmm.
But thinking back to that collapse of being into doing, this incapacity to be able to distinguish between act and attraction, how would you answer him now if you had a chance? in terms of where that broke down and why the analogy he said about Catholics and our worship doesn't fit appropriately to the worship of the self in same-sex activity.
I don't know, because I think I scored the point. He admitted that this was indeed a parallel case, but he didn't go on from there. I recall we talked about C.S. Lewis. He mentioned C.S. Lewis somewhere, and he quoted him favorably. I said, "Do you like C.S. Lewis?" He said, "Oh, I love the Chronicles of Narnia." I said, "Oh, good. What else have you read?" He said, I read Mere Christianity, but I hated it." Why? Well, I like him as a novelist. I like his. I think I'd like him if I met him, but I can't believe what he believes. I said, "Why do you call yourself a Catholic then? Don't you have to be a mere Christian first before you can be a Catholic?" He said, "Well, by your definition, yes, but that's not where I'm coming from."
I remember a conversation I had when I was back in college, and this computer programmer, very intelligent, who wanted to disabuse me of my heterosexism. And we were having this conversation, and he brought up the scholastic principle of act following being. Mm-hmm. And I said, "You know, is basically what you're saying that you think your same-sex activity is compulsive?" Kind of paused. He said, "Well, I wouldn't really use that term." I said, "Well, but let's, do you have freedom there?"
Mm-hmm.
Because from my perspective, we were able to grasp him on his basically trying to say that he has no freedom left, that it's become something subhuman.
Yep.
So, whereas for us, with the act of praying or adoring or following according to our Catholic identity, that action is always supposed to be free.
Yes.
It's not compulsive.
Yes.
And that, I think, is kind of where the first breakdown would occur. The second would be what the real being that's being followed is. And what I've discovered in my work as a chaplain for Courage is that the primary self-identifying characteristic of a person with same-sex attractions is their sexual attraction, which is never really the case for heterosexuals.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about yourself. For a heterosexual, it would come up 28 or 30th. Oh, yeah, by the way, I'm attracted to women.
Mm-hmm.
But they forget about who their real being is, especially for a Catholic, where their primary self-identifying characteristic ought to be that they're a beloved son of God.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
The devil
is jealous. He will not allow things number 21 through 27 to stay in place when 28 is upset.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I should think that would be, how should I put it, an opportunity for us. What are you missing? These other things that I identify myself with, you don't.
Mm-hmm. And I think fundamentally it's because they think chastity. They have no idea what chastity really is. And I phrased it once as sometimes when you mention chastity to someone who's engaged in same-sex activity, they think that it's a special medieval punishment that is inflicted in Vatican subterranean dungeons. that it's not something that actually leads us to freedom.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something that helps us to really be attracted to the personal dignity of the other, rather than just reducing to sexual values or the erogenous zones or things like this. And with some, if they're open to sort of just a conscience logic of not using people.
Yeah, they would identify it with the inscription on the medieval knight's chastity belt: "Make war, not love."
just on what Roger said there, I feel that I might be misunderstanding it, because I've heard that the point raised several times, and I've actually maybe argued it, but about the whole thing, your primary identity as a kind of beloved son and the son of God. But I don't think that any person who I've had a general conversation with, a heterosexual person, has said, well, you know, when I ask about them, I don't think anyone has ever said to me, well, I'm a beloved son of God. So it might be there, but it's not something that kind of strikes them as being distinctive. And so maybe you could flesh that out as to, like, I can definitely see somebody who's homosexual saying, "Oh, I'm gay and I'm proud," are you have the ones who won't say anything and just doesn't, you know, for whatever reason. But I've never heard a heterosexual person say, first and foremost, I'm beloved.
Well, how is the question framed? Doesn't that determine everything?
Maybe. Well, it's.
What is the meaning of your life?
It would be, you know, if I'm sitting down chatting with people and at the dinner table or something, we just talk about work, talk about life and all of that kind of stuff. And I actually would have to push it a little bit to go into the religious dimension. And so I can see the whole thing that we should be kind of first and foremost thinking of ourselves as you know, especially as baptized Christians, as sons and daughters and Son of God. But yet I can see if you ask anybody about themselves, the first things that they will bring up quite often are what makes them distinctive. They won't say, oh, I'm a regular person from a regular family. And for the gay person, this is one of the things that probably makes them distinctive.
You know, I've been stopped. I'm just going through Harvard Square to get stopped to sign petitions, and more than once it's happened that they'll, you know, for the gay marriage petition, and then they'll see the college. Oh, sorry about it. And then I've gone back and just what you said, and Ron replied. I mean, I said, well, do you know why I can't sign it? And they're like, yeah, of course. And I talked to them about, you know, the bill of goods that are being sold and what they were really called to be was saints, that they had this attraction. Mm-hmm. A lot of saints that had this attraction, yep. But they were called to this. And they'd be very receptive to it,
mm-hmm.
of course, because it is true.
Yeah.
But they wouldn't know to bring it up, but if you bring it up sincerely with them, it is true about them, and it brings them up.
This is a part of the battlefield where we can't avoid. We have to go into it. It's precisely the difficulty and the depth of it that require our involvement. And even if we don't have a confidence in what we're going to say, we don't have a battle plan, we don't have the four spiritual laws to open up dialogue and to get respectful hearing on both sides, I think that's awfully important.
You spoke quite a bit at the beginning about Sigmund Freud. I'm sure you must know the book, The Question of God,
Sigmund Freud, by Nikolai.
I thought it was wonderful. If you could recommend it, could you tell the brothers a little bit about it?
Armand Nikolai is a psychiatrist who teaches at Harvard. I think he's an Anglican. He teaches a course on Freud and C.S. Lewis as two opposite philosophies of life. And he doesn't reveal to the class that he's a Christian. And he deals with Freud first. He's very sympathetic to Freud, so they all think that he's a Freudian. And the first half of the course makes them, maybe not Freudians, but at least respect Freud. And then he brings in C.S. Lewis as the alternative, and he says half the class, their mind open. Wow, there's an alternative. What? That makes sense. Good grief. And then after class, they often ask him, where do you stand? And he said, well, I don't want to say this in class, not because I'm afraid of Harvard, because that's not my business, but I firmly believe that Lewis is right. I'm a Christian. You are? My goodness, you seem so scientific. things go on from there. Now, that's a great book, The Question of God by Armand Nikolai.
Yeah.
It's also a TV series. I think it's on PBS.
Yes.
But the book is the course, obviously.
Yes. It's a very popular course, by the way. You get hundreds of students in it.
Thank God.
What are the limits of the theology of the body? I'm thinking particularly in the education of the young. The catechesis in grade school, for instance, middle school, especially in relation to sex education.
Well, I immediately think of two limits. One is the language in which it's phrased. We haven't yet translated it into simple, punchy, attractive terms. Certainly, John Paul II wasn't known for that kind of language. And Christopher West's earlier books, I think, are very good. He's gone into some flaky and questionable things lately, which I think he wants to apologize for, but I don't know. But the other thing that's needed in the theology of the body, I think, is to connect it with everything else, traditional Catholic morality, the natural law, metaphysics, in a way that ordinary people can understand. So that it's not an isolated entity. This is about sex, and here's the rest of your life.
I think, just if I can answer, I'm doing 6th, 7th, and 8th grade TOB, I call it TOB, and Ascension is doing it, and is tying all of it together.
Great.
So it's Ascension Press. It's
great, they're doing a great job. Yep.
Theology of the Body for middle school, and I'm teaching 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, and it's fantastic.
Are the students interested?
I'm sorry?
Are the students interested?
Very.
Yeah, you get them that young and they're interested. By the time they're at BC, they're not. They're ideologized.
I also use it for high school as well, and the kids in high school also get it. It ties it beautifully together, and it's cohesive. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, it's going to be a little more practical. It's more innocent, obviously, mm-hmm. which is
yep.
where you want
yep.
it to go with it. Ascension Press definitely does it.
That's where we got to get them. Secondary school education is crucial. College is too late.
I didn't say you got to get them 6th, 7th, 8th.
Yeah.
It's already there.
Right.
It's already there.
Right.
Could you say a word about how it seems to me the more that women take on roles that were more traditionally associated with men, the more they also take on all the vices that were traditionally associated mm-hmm. with men,
yeah.
Including like physical violence mm-hmm. against each other, sexual abuse,
yep.
all kinds of everything. And do you see increases of that over your career
oh,
as an
yes.
educator?
Over my career as a driver. Either men are becoming more gentlemanly or women are the opposite. Yes. If we had a strong sense of our identities as persons, then making the roles more flexible would be a healthy thing. But since our identity as persons is less secure as a society than it used to be, making those roles interchangeable is devastating because that reflects on our identities now. Yeah.
And I guess the next thing is with the development of metrosexuals for males means that in another few years all the guys will have to spend all this money on pedicures and
that. Canada.
And then that's when the women will start.
We'll all become Canadians.
Well, we have some Canadians.
Nice. Polite.
One more time for one more question.
There's only four Canadians here.
Don't be nice. You cannot insult a Canadian. They are nice to you no matter how insulting you like them.
You commented on a book by Budzhevsky there on the meaning of sex.
By whom?
Jay Budzhevsky.
Budzhevsky, yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about it? Is it worthwhile?
Definitely. Anything by Budzhevsky is worthwhile. Yes.
The meaning of sex.
The meaning of sex. Excellent book. Very clear, very straightforward. Philosophical and practical at the same time. Basic church teaching, a little bit of the theology of the body in there. It's a great book. Highly recommended. I'd say high school level. Yep. One last one. That was a half a question.
One of the things I heard recently from nun in Quebec, she's a sexologist, and she's talking about
of course she
is. I was astounded that she actually said something that struck me and I thought was true. She said that our children today are basically victims of the pornographic culture. And it really just like struck me the way she put that. And I said, yes, you know, 12-year-olds, they're all masters of the computer now. They're so easy mm-hmm. to get involved. And she's talked a lot about how as they get older, they don't know how to relate to people because everybody's been objectified. They can't
yep.
enter into proper relationships. Mm-hmm. My question is basically, how do we look at the healing process? Like, where do we need to go? I think theology of the body is one of it, but I think it has something to do with the family.
Relationships are supposed to be here. Computer pornography is supposed to be there. They've been reversed.
Mm-hmm.
So do we attack computer pornography, or do we start by establishing relationships? We start by establishing relationships, because then we get the credibility for our attack on computer pornography. We restore what's missing.
Building stronger families, for sure.
For sure. Mm-hmm.